You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy. Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show. Once again, and as always, I am Mallory Ortberg, also known as Dear Prudence. In the studio today, we have a fabulous guest, Shafika Hudson, and we get to talk about our own impending mortality and upholstery-induced rage. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk a little bit about a type of letter I've been getting a lot lately, of which this is sort of an illustrative example. They're usually titled something like, "How do I go on?" As is this one, "How do I go on?" And it just reads this: "Honestly, I just need a little advice on how not to fall into a spiral of hopelessness with everything that's been going on since the inauguration. Every time I open the news or surf the web, I'm more and more frightened for anyone who isn't straight, white, Christian, and male. I find myself getting angrier and angrier, and it's bleeding into my personal relationships. I've always tried not to shun people for their beliefs if they're different from mine, but I'm struggling to maintain even a baseline of respect for others. I don't want to spend the next 4 years like this. Help." I think I just want to start by acknowledging it is rough out there. You are experiencing a sense of hopelessness, frustration, and anger, and that is an appropriate response to our current situation. You're not reading things wrong. You're not a person who can't control their emotions. Like, you are under an extraordinary amount of stress, and you are responding appropriately. And that sucks because, you know, often when we're faced with stress, if we can respond either by like lashing out or running away, we can like pause and reboot after that. But in this case, the stress keeps on coming. So there's sort of a couple different strategies in terms of like, how do you care for yourself in the short term? How do you manage your emotions? How do you have productive conversations? How do you get your job done? How do you seek to help people who are being actively persecuted? And how do you do all of that without, you know, just totally losing it? Because, you know, I don't want any of you to totally lose it. I would like you to be able to lead your lives in ways that feel mostly productive, useful, serene, content, if not happy, and like you're able to meet whatever situation you're faced with. So a couple of different thoughts, right, on how specifically to deal with life as we are beginning to experience it under the Trump administration. I think one of the things that is the most helpful way, the most helpful response to have to these feelings of hopelessness and powerlessness is to find appropriate action. I think that acting, doing things both in your own community and in terms of the country at large, will go a long way towards addressing those feelings of hopelessness. I think that's not to say that if you can volunteer enough or donate enough, you will not experience any sort of distress or panic. But I do believe that it will do more to address that terror than just turning off the news, watching a movie that you like, taking a bubble bath, none of which are bad things, right? But I think sometimes it's possible to sort of like take the basic advice of like, take care of yourself, relax, do something good, and sort of lean into that so hard that you end up just checking out. That's not necessarily something that's going to happen to everybody. You'll kind of be a good judge. I know I'm the type of person who, if I hear an expression like self-care, I'll think, ah, self-indulgence, and I'll just like get pedicures until I die. And that's not the kind of person I want to be. That's not a useful way to be in the world. So to kind of bear in mind, what do I need to do in order to like get through the day? But also, is the right thing right now to do something restful, or is the right thing right now to seek to help somebody or to seek to use my time and resources in a way that is useful to my community and not just to myself? like particularly if you are looking for ways to help refugees or people of uncertain immigration status in your community. There's a lot of ways to do that. One of which is you can donate either your time or your money to the International Rescue Committee, which does a lot of great work with refugees. You can also, they have kind of a script for ways to make phone calls to your representative. And I want to put in a real plug for making calls to your representative. That's generally a more effective way to communicate like their constituents' desires than email. It's also really helpful to have specific goals when you make those phone calls, to let them know there's either a bill that you would like them to throw their support behind or to disavow. And I think you should do this regularly. Like, get used to doing this on a weekly basis. Set an alarm on your phone. Do it once a week. There's, you know, it's not something you have to do that's going to take more than like 5 minutes out of your week. But it's a helpful way to become slightly more engaged with politics at a slightly more local level. And again, like, encourage you to do it, like, in terms of your city, in terms of your state, like, in terms of your state senate. There's often going to be bills coming up that will be very distressing and that will be, like, geared towards disenfranchising people. And it's great to, like, keep abreast of that. So I've got a representative, Dianne Feinstein, who has been approving Trump nominees, and I really don't want her to. So I'm calling a lot. You should also ask your representative to support the Bridge Act, which stands for Bar Removal of Individuals Who Dream and Grow Our Economy. It's designed to protect youth under DACA. DACA, if you're not familiar, is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And it like attempts to protect young people who came to the United States as children. It maintains their eligibility to work and live in the United States without the fear of deportation. You know, there's like 750,000 of young people right now in this country who benefit from DACA, most of whom came here as children. America's their only home. They've, you know, joined the military. They're at college. They're like, you know, members of the community, and, you know, they need support. When it comes to, you know, I think we're all aware at this point that, like, the ACLU has gotten more donations in the last couple of weeks than they normally do in a year. And that's fabulous. And there's a lot of other organizations that support, like, specifically, you know, folks who are refugees or immigrants. Like, there's Oxfam, there's UNICEF, there's Doctors Without Borders, there's the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, there's Refugees Welcome. Find organizations in your area that are local to your community that you feel like will offer support to people who are going to be or are already are actively threatened by legislation that's coming down the pike. If there is a mosque or a Muslim community center in your neighborhood, let them know that you welcome them in your community, that if there's ever anything that they need, you would love to be helpful. In the wake of the violence we've seen against mosques and people who attend mosques in the last couple of weeks, like, I think that's a hugely significant thing that you can do. And I think it's important to find stuff that you do regularly, right? Not just once, but on a monthly or a weekly basis so that it becomes a part of your life. Because I think one thing that would be easier to do is to feel really, really bad. And then to do one or two big things to sort of exercise those bad feelings and then sort of forget about it until you feel really, really bad again, or to feel so overwhelmed and paralyzed that you don't end up doing anything. And I think that would just make you continue to feel worse. So I think find manageable, repeatable action that you're capable of doing and that's useful, and do that and let other people know that you're doing it and encourage them to do the same. I want to welcome to the studio our guest, Shafika Hudson. She is a freelance writer and author who is based in D.C., and we have known each other through the internet for many a year, which I feel like is a recurring theme with a lot of our guests, which brings me a great deal of joy. And today is the first time we're getting to speak with one another with voices, and that's really exciting to me. Hi, Shafika, welcome.
Hi, Mallory. It's really good to hear your voice, too.
This is a dream. I can't wait to have you on the show. Are there any like thoughts and feelings about advice that you've just like kept pent up inside you that you can't wait to share today?
Oh, well, I'm such a busybody, just sort of by nature. So I'm actually going to go ahead and exercise some restraint and not give any advice that nobody asked me for.
That is a noble goal to which to aspire, and I'm really excited to try to break that down throughout the course of this episode. And actually, like, to that end, I'm going to start with the first question because I have a feeling we're going to have some thoughts. I'm going to go ahead and read the first letter. The subject is Irish Americans can't be racist. Dear Prudence, a friend of mine has started saying that he can't have white privilege because he's of Irish descent. His family's been in America for generations. And the Irish used to be persecuted and experienced genocide. I tried to explain that white privilege is a collective, presumed status that doesn't necessarily mean each white individual is of greater personal status than everyone else. But he still insists that he's not privileged, even though he grew up in a middle-class, white picket-fence neighborhood. He claimed that Irish history is important and needs to be part of the discussion about race and privilege, and the fact that no one recognizes this is, in itself, racist. Personally, I think the people who are being actively persecuted right now should lead the conversation, and we shouldn't try to say that because some white people were persecuted in the past, we can't be racist or privileged now. I'm considering not talking to him anymore. What do you think? Oh, boy. This is, you've heard this before, right? The, like,
yeah.
Irish...
Yeah, the Irish genocide, enslaved Irish, just pretty much the gamut of Irish oppression. This is absolutely a familiar argument. If I sound a little weary, it's because I really have heard this one a lot. And it's what it illustrates to me more than anything else is a lack of full understanding of the nature of certain types of oppression, racism, class difference. There's all kinds. And generally speaking, one doesn't negate the other.
Right.
Just that's sort of not something that really happens. One of the things I'd like to touch on very briefly is that lots of cultures that now sort of have a degree of privilege because they're recognized in the United States, certainly, as white, have gone through, have suffered through and survived through genocides. I'm thinking Armenians. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about recent genocides, and of course, there was the Holocaust, and you could definitely make the argument that because those people are viewed as white Americans, they have a completely different experience of oppression now in the 21st century in America. There's a good deal of social capital. And by the way, I've discussed this at length for so many years and for such a long time that I use a lot of terms that a lot of people aren't necessarily familiar with.
Right.
So if I say something and you think it would be helpful for me to explain, please go ahead.
Yeah,
stop
yeah.
me. Go, hey, back it up. What does that mean?
Absolutely. Well, I was thinking especially, too, because I don't think either of us would say that Irish history is not important or shouldn't be recognized or that
absolutely.
There hasn't been, you know, persecution of Irish people both in Ireland and in the United States. And that, of course, is real and serious and should be discussed. But there's sort of a process in America by which various ethnic groups have sometimes been sort of enfolded into whiteness, right? Like mm-hmm. drawn into the warm bosom of whiteness and sort of said, that's done and you're part of the gang now. And that's sort of bananas, right? Like that's it's part of why this whole like idea of race being this really like stable, immutable definition is silly. But it always happens sort of with the backdrop of what are the groups that can never get put on that sort of like moving walkway of increased whiteness. And the difference between that and this situation.
Well, you've touched on so many things that are so crucial to these discussions. And thank you. And P.S. moving walkway. Oh, my gosh. That's a great way to put it. I'm sitting here and I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, now, what didn't I ever put it that way? That's a perfect
way
like
to put
it. Yeah,
like just at an airport, it just speeds you up and it gets you to the gate. And then it's like, welcome to your gate. We're so glad you're here, even though like a few minutes ago you were not here.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's a perfect way to put it, because what we've seen over the centuries is as various groups from various parts of Europe have immigrated and established a presence in the United States, there have been degrees of assimilation. Part of the both implicit and explicit deal, as it were, of Americanness is that when you become American, you become white.
Right.
And white becomes monoculture. And that is what American is, basically, a white ethnicity-lessness, as it were. That's what the melting pot is. When they say the melting pot, that's actually what they mean. It's less a melting pot and more of a bleaching pot. Wherein you go ahead and you enter and you discard whatever previous culture you had, all of the prickly bits, the language, anything that might be viewed as too esoteric and strange, it just gets sort of tossed out.
Right, which so is sort of like how you could get somebody who would have this conversation and yet presumably would not like speak Gaelic at home to any
right.
of their like older family members, would not be like sending money back to relatives in Ireland necessarily. Not that that's impossible to happen, of course, but like mm-hmm. as a group, like Irish Americans do not like have that connection in mm-hmm. part because like collectively they were absorbed into this big white American group. And again, like there's a big difference between that and folks who like by definition will never be put on that moving walkway.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's an important sort of touchstone to always remember to bring to light because what we understand as white American monoculture wouldn't exist without an outgroup. It's just a fact. You have to have people who you understand cannot partake and will never be allowed to partake in the full idea of Americanness. Now, it's just speaking for myself. I'm on one side of my family, just one side of my family. I'm an 11th generation American. But when people picture an American, they don't picture myself, a black woman. They just don't. But if you wanted to make the argument that at least in my immediate circle of friends, which is pretty global, I'm probably the most American person there.
Right.
You definitely could. So, I mean, that's one of America's racial ironies, unfortunately. But one of the things that I think it's important to remember is that whiteness comes at a price.
Hmm.
And it's one that people in the outgroup pay.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not a meritocracy in any sense. It's framed as meritocracy where the idea is that everybody comes here, you know, if you come here with nothing, bootstraps.
Right.
And you sort of like make your way towards American comfort and it's something that you have because you deserved it and you earned it. No one ever says, okay, well, you have it. And I'm not saying you didn't work hard for it, but you have it at the expense of people who can never have it.
Right. And
so,
I think,
yeah,
I'm thinking back to, I kind of want to address the letter writer again, because this has been sort of like a big picture conversation. It seems like the letter writer and their friend are sort of talking at cross purposes, because the letter writer's friend wasn't saying like, no, the Irish are being persecuted right now just as badly as like, you know, Muslim Americans or Black Americans or people who have like, you know, immigrant status that like makes them vulnerable. Mm-hmm. He's just sort of like saying nobody pays enough attention to Irish history, which is sort of not what the letter writer is trying to talk about. Right. Like,
right.
Of course, Irish history is important. And of course, you can discuss like ways in which Irish people have been persecuted, both like in their home country and abroad. And that also doesn't mean that it is the same as all other forms of like persecution or oppression. Like there's no movement of like, man, Irish Americans are being like killed by police officers in disproportionate mm-hmm. numbers. Irish Americans are not at threat of being like deported. So like just kind of on its face, like I think the friend is presumably at least somewhat aware that this is not like the right argument. Like, that's not in question. And like, if he wants to talk about his own history or like get in touch with that or learn more about it, he is, of course, perfectly welcome to. But it's interesting that he feels like what happened to Irish people in America, say, 120 years ago, mm-hmm. apparently needs to be at the forefront of a conversation that's about what's happening to other people right now. And I wonder why he would rather discuss past oppression than present oppression.
Well, I have a theory.
What's your theory?
Because I've encountered this particular framing of the argument before, and it overwhelmingly comes up during discussions of chattel slavery in the United States. And I've arrived at the conclusion that this is somewhat of a subconscious guilt dodge. Because there's really no other reason to kind of equate oppression that was experienced by the Irish some time ago with slavery. My goodness. Or even, you know, let's say from like slavery to, I guess, the end of the civil rights era. So because it's not quite the same. I don't do the whole what's sort of loosely termed within my circle, in certain circles, is oppression Olympics.
Yeah, yeah. Right, like who's going to get that terrible gold medal?
Exactly. The thing that nobody really wants to be competing in, but somebody's got to win, darn it.
Right.
I think that I agree with you that that deserves, Irish history certainly deserves its own discussion. It really does, because it's significant. And I mean, it's not even, if you wanted to talk about oppression, it's not even that far, you know, that long ago.
Right.
The Troubles, as they were called, that happened in my in your lifetime, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's not like he's not making a valid argument. It's just, it's kind of weird that that this would come up just sort of randomly. I'm more concerned about him stating that he doesn't have white privilege, because that's not how that works.
Right.
At all. You don't say, okay, well, what you're talking about, I don't have. Privilege is invisible.
Right.
It's invisible.
It's also collective. I mean, like, just like when you think about the history of things like redlining, like the way that the GI Bill was designed to help white service members and their families amass property and pass it down through multiple generations, like a pretty cursory study of like property laws, districting laws, like who mortgages are given to in this country shows that like it has disproportionately favored white people over other groups, particularly black people. And that's simply reality. Like that's not, it doesn't mean necessarily like your grandfather was a bad person and it's all his fault. It doesn't necessarily mean you haven't experienced suffering in your own life. It's just a fact about the financial history of this country. And as such, it's not mitigated by other sufferings that can be very real, but don't in any way subtract from that reality. It's sort of like saying, I can't have hurt your feelings just now because my mother left me when I was seven. Like, it's sad that your mother left when you were seven. That's painful and sad, and you should be able to talk about that. That doesn't have any bearing on whether or not you just hurt my feelings in this moment. Like those two things are not related, and it's unreasonable and unwarranted to want to connect them. So I think I would encourage the letter writer to try to discuss it that way, and to make it clear. Look, I'm not trying to take anything away from you. I'm not trying to like deny suffering that Irish people have experienced, but you should also be aware the ways in which Irish people have been folded into whiteness in America in ways that other groups haven't. And there's ways in which other people are suffering right now that does not have anything to do with the historical ways that Irish people have been oppressed. And you can care about more than one thing at the same time. That's one of the wonderful gifts of having a human brain and being able to balance multiple thoughts at once.
Yes, absolutely. And well said. Well said, Mallory, certainly. I was struck by how the letter writer seems to have a much better grasp of structural oppression than their friend. And I think if you wanted to keep the friendship, that might be the best place to start, because it's been my experience talking with friends who deal with this on a much more personal level. Like I've been very fortunate. Most of my close friends and I and my family, you know, we're pretty much on the same page politically and in terms of like right and social justice and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But I have friends who have family and close friends who are all over the political spectrum. And I think recently, certainly mm-hmm. with the political climate in our country, certain things have sort of begun to stand out in relief.
Right.
And if we're going to have these discussions, I think, and maintain friendships and maintain relationships, we're going to have the discussions from a broader perspective that's right. less personal.
Right.
Because people feel really, really personal about this a lot of the time.
It's true. And I think that's good to bear in mind. Like, I would encourage this letter writer, especially because the conversation you guys are trying to have is about your friend's inability to understand sort of the difference between mm-hmm. personal culpability and structural privilege.
Yes.
Is that's something you can talk about, right? That's different from, like, he's been saying a lot of awful racial slurs, because that's sort of like, there you just have to draw a line and say that's unacceptable. You know that's unacceptable. But this is something you can discuss.
Absolutely.
So I would say, like, give it a try. That doesn't mean you have to spend, like, the next month calling them every day being like, we've got to hash this out. But it's definitely worth, I think, continuing this conversation and trying to make it clear. I'm not trying to threaten you. I'm not trying to take this away. Mm-hmm. You can see both of these things at the same time. I encourage you to, like, learn about this. And also, like, at a certain point, if it feels like the conversation is not going to go in a productive direction, like, you can take a pause and just, you know, try to be useful to that person, encourage them to sort of interrogate some of their own ideas. Don't, you know, make this only a friendship where all you do is, like, meet in a park once a week and fight about privilege. But give it a try. Give it a try. And if like, they're the worst and it's just impossible, like, you may need to back off for a while. But I think this is a situation where, like, there's a real possibility for conversation here.
Mm, absolutely.
Before we move on to the next letter, too, I just want to jump back and kind of acknowledge, because I know we talked a little bit about that moving walkway and mentioned a couple mm-hmm. of different ethnic groups. And I just want to acknowledge, too, globally, there are lots of Jewish people who are not white. And we're
Absolutely.
Sort of talking specifically about in America and ways in which you can be granted conditional white privilege that can sometimes mm-hmm. be sort of taken away. And I just want to acknowledge that, like, I'm not saying, like, all Jewish people are white. There are, you know, people of various Jewish traditions all over the world, all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds. And even in the United States, there's often, as we're seeing now, a real push and pull between people, like, racial and ethnic attacks upon Jewish people still exist. So just want to acknowledge that, like, that's complicated and not trying to like, make any sweeping claims.
Absolutely. And if I could just jump in with a book recommendation.
Please do.
Oh, my gosh. Every conversation I have has a book recommendation.
I'd like to think
that's because I'm living my life right, but we'll see.
Yeah.
The book I'd recommend is How the Irish Became White. It is a classic. It's a critical race analysis classic. And I wouldn't advise anybody get into this conversation in any serious and emotional way without having this incredibly vital book by Noel Ignatieff.
Okay.
It's about 20 years old now. I'm pretty sure it was published in the mid-90s, but it's really illuminating. And it goes into painstaking detail about both the construction of race, which has no biological basis. And I think that's something most people are aware of. But it just sort of shows you step by step how a group moved from being despised mm-hmm. and oppressed and excluded to being American.
Hmm. Thank you so much, by the way. I hope that you have, like, a book recommendation for each letter.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oof. All right. The subject of the next letter is friendship abandonment. Dear Prudence, I had been friends with Evie for several years. She was dating a guy named Dan at the time, and I never really warmed up to him. One night at a party, he got drunk and made a pass at me. I told him to go sleep it off, and he grabbed my arm and wouldn't let go. Luckily, someone else came into the room, and Dan eventually let go, but it scared me. What's worse is that he texted me the next day and admitted it. He asked me not to tell Evie. I went straight to her, showed her the messages and the bruise he left on my arm. Evie refused to believe me and said that I had to be misinterpreting things. Then she dropped me completely. I later learned through mutual friends that she got engaged to Dan pretty soon after that. That sent me into a depressive spiral. I considered Evie one of my closest friends, and it made me doubt my own memory sometimes. A couple of years have gone by, and out of the blue, I got an email from Evie. She wanted to see how I was doing and if we could meet up, as if we had merely drifted apart instead of her cutting me out of her life. I Googled both of them and found a news article where Dan had been arrested for assault and battery of a woman during a New Year's Eve party. I haven't responded yet. I don't know how to. Part of me misses Evie and part of me wants to confront her. Should I arrange to meet up and see what happens? Call her? Ignore it?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know what? Kudos to the letter writer for even leaving space for this person to re-enter their lives because, even considering it, I just speaking from my own perspective,
yeah.
Personally, there's no way.
Yeah.
Straight to voicemail. We're not friends on any of the books.
Yep.
Yeah. So, kudos to her for being compassionate and open to mending fences.
Right.
That's tremendous. I am really anxious to hear your recommendation.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what do I feel like are the most important threads here? What are the most important things to bear in mind? One of the things that I think we should acknowledge is the possibility that Dan was also assaulting Evie.
If
he was willing.
I didn't even think about that. You're right.
I didn't think that on my first pass either. And it's entirely possible. There's lots of different ways for abuse and dysfunction to manifest itself. And it's often possible for people who commit acts of abuse and assault to hide that from a partner and to visit it on other people. But it is also possible that he was hurting Evie too. And I don't say that because therefore, it would make her response to your situation acceptable, or that would mean that you guys could become friends again. I just want to acknowledge that is a possibility. And if that's the case, then I would hope very much that Evie could also find help and support. It's also possible that he did not hurt her, and that whenever he did hurt somebody else and she was presented with the facts, she chose to deny them and defend him. And so just kind of bearing in mind that there are many possibilities in between those two things to just bear that in mind when it comes to dealing with Evie. I'm certainly with you. I don't think there's a version of the world where the letter writer could rekindle a friendship with Evie. I think there are just some baselines that you need to meet to be in a friendship with someone. And one of them is would you tell me that I was misunderstanding things if I showed you a bruise on my arm and a text message from your boyfriend admitting that he'd tried to assault me the night before? I mean, that's not... If you cannot get behind a friend and defend them and support them and drop that boyfriend, that doesn't mean you're an irredeemably bad person who's never capable of changing and making amends and becoming better if at some point you decide to. But it does mean that you've forfeited that friendship permanently.
Absolutely.
I think that means that is not a friendship that's ever going to have a healthy foundation again. So I think to bear that in mind, when you needed her the most, when you provided her with pretty irrefutable testimony that her boyfriend had tried to seriously harm you, she called you a liar. And that's even if she was being hurt herself then, then you would have sympathy for her situation. You would want her to get help. You would wish her the best. But that doesn't mean that you should let her back into your life. So I think kind of acknowledging that you do miss Evie, the person that you knew before this happened, that's absolutely real. And you have to kind of mourn that, right? Because the choice that she made to disbelieve you also took away the beautiful parts of your friendship that you miss. And that's sad. But don't let that drive your actions. Don't think maybe there's a way to get that friendship back if Dan is now out of the picture, which we don't know. She may still be with him. He may be facing charges and she might be standing by her man.
For me, a huge feature of friendships, especially very close friendships, is emotional safety. Mm-hmm. And that's a concept that I don't think I don't really hear people talking about it. But for healthy relationships, I think you have to feel emotionally safe. Like, you can be as vulnerable as you need to with this person without fear that they'll hurt you.
Hmm.
And to me, when you're attacked, you're certainly in a vulnerable place. And when you turn to a friend to just let them know what's going on, you know, the person that they're with maybe isn't the safest person to be around and might actually be at least a little bit of a jerk, at the least. And that's the reaction you get, that person isn't you're not emotionally safe with them.
Yep.
At all.
Yeah. So,
and for me, that's a deal breaker.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think we're both in agreement that, like, reconciliation with Evie is not possible. It's not desirable. You know, again, if you're not already in therapy about this, I would really encourage you to do so, because I think you deserve to have somebody who is just, like, there to help you process this, who's there to champion you, who's there to be on your side in terms of just, like, what you deserve in terms of respect and safety. I think you have two options. One is to ignore this email, which, if you feel like, I don't know how I could have a productive conversation with her, I feel like hurt and bewildered that she's emailing me as if we just lost touch, as opposed to, because it's not even right that she said, you're lying, let's pretend it never happened. She said, you're lying, and then she stopped talking to you. So, like, she also decided that she was willing to cut you out of her life because you told her that her boyfriend attacked you. That's awful. So, ignoring it is definitely an option. The other option I think you have is writing something back that just says, you know, I'm surprised to hear from you. It seems like you're asking to catch up. I wanted to say this, like, I want to acknowledge this. And I would probably encourage you to do this in writing just because it can be helpful to organize your thoughts, especially because you got the email to begin with. But to just say, the reason our friendship ended is because your boyfriend Dan attacked and tried to sexually assault me. I showed you my bruises and a text message from him admitting that he had done this. You told me that I was misinterpreting things and you stopped talking to me. If you would like to apologize for that, I am willing to listen. If, however, you are getting in touch because you would like to pretend that that did not happen, I'm not interested in having that conversation. And that, I think, would be an email that would be okay to send. But you would have to ask yourself, you know, do I want to hear that from her? Would I want to open myself up to the possibility that she would send back an email that was argumentative? Like, would that be difficult or traumatizing for you to see? You know, would you be willing to meet with her if she wanted to? Do you feel safe doing that? You know, what responses would you feel okay with? And what would it look like if she did apologize and was able to do it in a way that was not like, oh, I'm sorry, mistakes were made, things were hard, who could have known? But like a real apology that was like, what I did was really wrong. I chose, like, the comfort of staying in a relationship over believing the truth and helping you after you were assaulted. And I can't make that up to you, but I just want you to know that, like, I'm trying to turn my life around and behave differently. And thank you for listening to me. Like, if she can do that, maybe that could be helpful or healing. But bear in mind that that's probably pretty small. So I think you could send that email, but sort of ask yourself and also a therapist, like, what do I want out of this? Do I actually want further contact? Or would it be better to just miss her but not contact her, right? Like, you can miss someone and acknowledge there are parts of the friendship you miss and also know, we can't get coffee. I can't listen to this, like, woman, like, order a scone and say that she's, like, taking this new class that she's really interested in. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not the conversation you should be having.
You can't. I mean, your friendship is changed regardless of whether or not you decide to reconcile. And that's the primary issue with reconciliations, I think, just in general, whatever the nature of the departure was.
Right.
One or both parties has to change in order for the dynamic to change. And that so rare.
Yeah. And so far, this email does not suggest that she has changed enough. Right.
Exactly.
Like, this wasn't an email saying, I owe you a massive apology. What I did was so wrong. This was an email that's sort of like, hey, I've already told you once that you weren't correctly interpreting reality. What if I now pretend that we just drifted apart instead of I cut you out of my life? And like, she's trying to see again if you will allow her to dictate the terms of reality to her. And that feels like the same behavior that showed up when you tried to tell her that her boyfriend assaulted you. Like, that's worrying. That suggests to me that she is only dimly aware that she did something wrong and not yet fully aware.
Exactly. And with situations like this, what makes me a little bit uncomfortable about Evie's approach is it's an accountability dodge. Hmm. Yeah, it doesn't seem like she's willing to sort of take agency. It's more like, well, you know, things happened, things were said.
Things were said. Mistakes were made.
Yeah. Just the very passive voice. Like, who could have known? No.
Yeah.
No, you don't get to do that.
Yeah.
You have to sort of, if you're going to honestly reconcile with someone, you really got to apologize. You got to get in there.
Yeah.
And say, hey, this was an agency issue and it was mine.
Yeah.
The mistakes were mine. I was super wrong.
Yeah.
I'd love to be your friend again. Barring that, can you please forgive me?
And I just want to put in a plug, too, for apologies that are not followed by reconciliation.
Yeah.
I think those are great. And I think apologies are not just like the recipe that you plug in order to get forgiveness or a new relationship. Like, it is mm-hmm. good to apologize for harmful behavior because the other person deserves that. It does not mean that if you do that, you get to have that friendship back. I think it's worth apologizing for the sake of making an amends for the harm you committed, and then also saying that stands on its own. That doesn't need to lead to anything else. It's just good now that I was able to do that. It doesn't mean we get to start again. Like, apologies can help, like, finalize something, but they don't always start something new.
Exactly. Well, and people have a tendency, unfortunately, to sort of view apologies as, you know, you put the apology coin in the slot. And you get the reconciliation cookies.
Right.
And no, that was never how life worked.
No.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
There was actually a letter in the column earlier this week from someone who had sort of like made a bad judgment call, had confessed their romantic feelings to a colleague that they had like a good office friendship with. And the colleague got really uncomfortable and at first said it was okay, but then eventually sort of like he unilaterally ended their friendship and now they're just like sort of tense colleagues. And the letter writer was like, how do I fix this? I understand why he doesn't want to talk about this, but like, what do I do besides quit? And it was just like, I don't think you should quit. I think you should take his lead. Like, he's being, you know, reserved but professional at work. Great, do your job. Like, you apologized. That didn't make it okay. And it's fine to just have a professional relationship with a professional colleague. Like, that's what you get to do now. You apologized, didn't make him want to become best friends again. And that means you're done.
Yeah. And it's not a lot of fun. You know, nobody likes bad feelings.
No.
But part of the fun of being a grown up is that you suck it up.
Yep.
This is one of those times that you have to do that. It's an unfortunate situation. Kudos to that person for having the courage to, you know, express themselves. But no one is under any obligation to be on the same page.
Especially when you work with them, right? I feel like we kind of have this idea if, like, you're really good friends with somebody or you think you're really good friends with somebody, that it's always a good idea to confess your feelings. And sometimes, like, even if somebody's your really good pal at work, they just want to work together and have fun and then go back to their life at the end of the day. And they're not actually super, like, you have to acknowledge, I think, when you want to tell somebody that you've known a while that you have romantic feelings for them, you've got to accept that there's a real possibility that not only will they say no, it will make them so uncomfortable that it will change the dynamic of your relationship forever. I feel like there's like lip service. Sometimes people saying like, I don't want to ruin the friendship. But a lot of times people just sort of soldier on anyways, like, it'll be fine. And it's like, it might not be fine.
No, it might not be. Well, as the saying goes, in situations like this, the heart wants what it wants.
Yeah, well, you know, the heart's dumb and it should shut up sometimes. Like, your heart's a big, dumb idiot and you should, like, leave it in your chest cavity and not let it run your mouth.
Yeah, it's got a job to do. It's not supposed to be articulating. Stop it. We're covered there. Right?
Oh, man. Our final question is about upholstery and gratitude. And I'm very excited to get to close on this one. Dear Prudence, I'm the handy one in my family. I am addicted to do-it-yourself and have successfully made a wedding dress, remodeled my parents' kitchen, and built a sailboat. My sister lives 8 hours north of me and begged me to go restore the dining room chairs that my grandparents gave her when they were downsizing. I drove 2 hours both ways to pick up the chairs. I sanded them, stained them, and reupholstered them for my sister. I worked on those chairs for a solid month. Our brother took the chairs to my sister when he went to visit her. Then she decided to change her color scheme and the fabric she sent didn't quite match, so she had the chairs redone. I feel like I have gotten sucker punched. I don't know if my sister doesn't consider my time valuable or just doesn't care. I don't know how to bring this up, or if I should, or if it would even do any good. Should I tell my sister how much this hurt me, or just always be busy when she needs my help on a project in the future? This felt like reading The Little Red Hen. Right? Who will help me harvest the grain?
Yeah.
Who will help me bake the bread? Nobody.
Oh, man. That would just burn my grits. It really would. I would be so upset if I were to do this favor, basically, for a family member. And I didn't feel that it was sufficiently appreciated. So, but I'm actually sort of anxious to hear how you'd handle this, because saying what I would do, which is probably curse out my relative. that's not productive. We're not going to go with.
Look, we very rarely counsel people to curse out their relatives. Maybe we should start.
No way.
Yeah. You could go steal the chairs back and, I don't know, turn them into a sculpture.
We're just paving the way for a less civil America. That's what we're doing.
I mean, I have a couple of questions for this letter writer. Like, did you tell your sister how long it was going to take you to work on these chairs? Like, was she aware that this was going to be like a month-long labor of love that would take just a ton of time and energy? Because sometimes people who are not addicted to DIY and have not built a sailboat will think like, oh, so-and-so loves doing this stuff. And they're really good at it. And I don't really know how long it would take. And I'll just ask them if they want to do a favor. And I'm sure they would tell me if it were too big or if it weren't working for them. And so they think everything's fine. So it's very possible that your sister's like, wow, my sibling like went out of their way to like help me out with these chairs. Awesome. Oh, by the way, the like top doesn't work with my new color scheme. I'm going to like switch out the fabric that people will sit on. What a fabulous end to this great story. Like everything's wonderful. And then you show up like breathing flames on her driveway. And you're not necessarily wrong and she's not necessarily wrong, but because you guys haven't communicated about it, you're furious and she's confused.
I was actually thinking that. I wonder if the sister even knows how angry the letter writer is, because
it doesn't sound It doesn't sound like the sister really was like, fuck you. I want different like fabric on the seating. It sounds like the sister was just like, this is what I would do if I bought chairs. Has no idea how this feels to you.
I think that that's probably a discussion that really needs to be had, because it sounds like the letter writer is understandably upset. But instead of like, you know, letting her know of just kind of being busy, no.
Yeah. No, that's not going to get you what you want.
That's not the answer.
Right? Like, that's not going to make you feel any less resentful. Your sister's not going to get clued into, like, how she hurt you, and you're just eventually going to blow up about something else later.
Exactly. And I'm thinking, you know, you'll have this discussion maybe around, like, a holiday dinner or a spat about stuffing turns into something
especially
completely
if it's
different.
At the sister's house and you're just like, I hate the seat covering on these chairs. and that will be sad for you guys. I don't want that for you.
Yeah.
So couple of things, right? Like, let's look at what you did, letter writer, which was you took on a month-long project without communicating to your client how long it would take. And you didn't charge. Like, you did this for free And I understand that not everyone wants to have really like transactional relationships with family members. I get it. But you should also think through at the beginning of a project, like, am I giving this person a gift to do with as they please when they are done with? Or am I giving this person like basically a version of my heart and saying, if you ever try to change it, you will harm me? Like, presumably what you want for your sister is to have great, sturdy, beautiful chairs that match her design taste, right? Mm-hmm. And so to that end, you don't want to give her chairs that she feels like are a millstone around her neck and that she can never change and that are symbols of her value for your time. But you should have, at the beginning of this, like, told her, hey, this is going to require, like, a couple of two-hour round trips, about a month of labor. And that's a lot for me. And you know, if you were willing to do that, but just to say at the beginning, like, this is going to be a really big project. I really love you. I'm excited. But I just want you to know. Or you could have even said, like, I want to give you a discounted family rate. But because this is, mm-hmm. like, work that a contractor would normally do, like, I'm going to charge you, I don't know, like, half of a market rate for this, or a quarter or whatever. Just something that would have sort of acknowledged to the both of you that this was not just, like, fun, easy, free on your part. Because I think that's probably what your sister assumed. And because you never corrected her, she did not realize. Like, I don't think your sister doesn't value your time. I think she doesn't know how much of your time this takes.
I agree. I think it's really a question of what's valued. And it's your recommendation that the letter writer sort of clarify what the chairs meant is very that's going to be crucial to that discussion whenever it is they decide to have it. Because, you know, when I give a gift and it's from the heart, and it gets returned for store credit, depending on the person, depending on the gift, depending on the occasion, I might be varying degrees of hurt. So and it's not really about the gift itself.
Yeah.
It's very rarely about the gift itself. It's the meaning behind all of it. And if people are on different pages about what something means or represents,
yeah,
there's going to be some serious miscommunication in her feelings.
Yeah.
And I'm getting the impression that to the sister, these were just some chairs.
Yep.
These were just some chairs.
Yep.
And this is something that, you know, you like to do. You have fun. You do it yourself with everything. And this is, I mean, I think this is sort of regarded less as labor.
Yeah.
More of something that you do for fun.
So
yeah.
I think have the conversation. I think wait until you're not feeling quite so sucker punched, because it's going to be pretty intense if you bring that level of frustration to your sister, who's, as far as she knows, everything's cool. I don't think, like, at this point, the chairs have been reupholstered, right? Like, the ship of fabric has sailed. That's not going to come back. So in case part of you was thinking, like, should I ask her to change it? Like, don't do that. But just let her know, like, hey, I kind of realized something that I don't want to do in the future, which is I took on this project not really thinking through how much time and energy it would take. I love you. I love doing this. It brought me a lot of joy. But it was really hard because I don't think I communicated like how much time I spent on this. So when you got them and sort of treated them like chairs that you just bought, like that felt really painful for me. But I also realized that like I didn't tell you that and allow you to make your own decision. Like you also, by the way, letter writer, had the option of being like, happy to get the chairs for you. But like you'll either need to pay me for the work of refurbishing them or hire a contractor yourself. Like that was an option that you had. To do, and you didn't take that. So think through, like, what's your goal in this conversation? Is it, like, hopefully it's make sure this doesn't happen again. And whether that's your sister saying, wow, I didn't realize it was so intense for you. In the future, I will just hire somebody because I don't want to put you in a situation where you're taking on more than you can handle and then getting upset. Or she can say, I'm really sorry. I didn't know. I love the chairs. I just wanted to tweak them so they would look great in my house. Every time I look at them, I think of you because, like, you still, like, fixed the majority of the chair, right? Like, the chair is still there. It still looks great. Like, you still did that. She just wanted the seat to be, I don't know, bluer.
Well, and I think that's generally the case with this kind of question. It seems like, wow, miscommunication. It just boils down to people being different. Yeah. And looking at things differently,
yeah,
and assigning different values.
Right, because you kind of think like, man, if I had done that, it would mean I didn't value this person's time. It would mean I thought their vision was lousy. And it's, you got to bear in mind, like, that doesn't necessarily mean that that was going through your sister's head at the time. She was seeing it differently.
Exactly.
Man.
Exactly.
Well,
it's always fascinating.
It is. It is fascinating. And that's it. That is the mailbag for today. So we did it. We fixed everything.
Wonderful.
Now, no one's ever going to die. Everyone's going to get exactly the chairs that they want. Friends will never let you down. And everyone's going to read How the Irish Became White.
You know, one of those would be great. So,
yeah. Especially if it was the no one ever dying. That would be number one on my list. I sure would like that.
I guess I'd take that over the book.
Are you afraid of that? How often would you say you think about, like, your own death?
My own mortality, probably more than someone my age. I'm a year shy of 40. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I definitely think about. But I've also had to sort of manage illness, a fairly serious illness, with other family members.
Mm-hmm. I should start asking all of my guests how they feel about their own death. I think this is going to become a recurring feature on the show.
I think that'd be amazing.
I would just sure like to live forever. I just sure would. But I don't think that that's going to pan out.
Well, it might not. I would definitely have a plan B.
Plan B is just like die. Die unwillingly.
But I appreciate your optimism, though.
Yeah, you know, the nice thing is I won't have to do anything, right? Like, death does not require my active participation. I pretty much just need to show up, and that's going to take care of itself. So so for at least one more week, I remain tremblingly and mortally yours, Prudence. Shafika, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
It was wonderful. You're fabulous. I hope that you don't die until you complete all the things you wanted to do and then some.
Oh, ditto. You and I, Mutual Admiration Society.
It's on.
Absolutely.
It's on. We're going to have you back on the show, and it's going to be amazing. And by that time, I will have made myself golden and invulnerable to death. Guaranteed.
I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Thank you so much. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you like this show, please go to iTunes and write us a review. We'd love to hear your feedback, and it helps more people find the show. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute tops.